Hello, this is Guillaume, the editor of RFN, and if you hear my voice before the intro, you know what that means, audio problems. Thankfully, I was able to use AI to try and fix the audio, make it a little bit more listenable. In the past, I think what would have had to happen is that I would have maybe had someone re-record all of their lines, or I basically would have had to edit them out of existence for one episode. But thanks to today's technology, I guess I can salvage this. At least I hope. The audio is not perfect, but it is better than it was. And so please enjoy the episode.
Welcome to Ready for Nintendo episode 852. And today is December 7, 2023, and we are recording this literally in the middle of the 19-hour Game Awards. We are on hour 37. It's never gonna fucking get. People in the theater like should be issued, I don't know. Adult diapers. This is fucking unbelievable how long this shit is.
So yeah, it goes on so a long far. Time. I mean, they started at what? Like, 4:30 my
7:30
time.
7:30 Eastern, and they said the main show, that's the pre-show, the main show is like 3 hours.
Yep.
So that comes out to 3.5 hours. That's like WrestleMania, John.
Yeah.
And I don't get to see The Undertaker walk up to the ring for 22 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. There's no Roman Reigns intro here. No, Apex Legends and Final Fantasy VII Rebirth
sure,
crossover.
Fuck it. Great.
Cool. Sure.
Fuck it.
That's where we're at in the show, by the way, everybody.
That's where we're at. Yeah, so if you wanna watch along with where we're at, Apex Legends Final Fantasy just dropped. So
yeah.
John's back, in case you haven't picked that up for this world premiere episode, every episode of Ready
for
Nintendo.
It's a world premiere of me.
It's a world premiere of John.
Uh-huh.
We've never heard Adam on the show before.
Yeah, I guess it's a world premiere of my next Iron Man streak, I guess. World
premiere.
Oh, God.
So you're going to be out next week?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. All right, cool. I want to introduce you to our new cast member, John Lindemann.
It's great to be here, everybody. To be a part of this legendary show. I've been a long time listener, first time
bullshit,
panelist.
Bullshit. first time listener.
I got you though, right? I got you. That was pretty clever. You have to admit.
First time listener, long time troll. Lon Jindeman is here. You didn't listen to a single goddamn second of the show while you were out, did you?
No, I didn't. I didn't. What do
so
you think?
You saw what I put on the. You, all right, hold on.
No,
you
I
saw
have
what
not
I put
seen
on the
anything.
Main...
I have not seen anything that you've posted. I have not seen any of your artwork. I haven't listened to either episode since I've been out. I will
you
assure you of that.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah, I don't know. You probably took pot shots at me in my absence, made your snarky little jokes. I did post on Mastodon, though, for our almost, I think, 100 followers on Mastodon, I think.
There we go.
Real people, though, James. So, those are real people.
Real
Respect them.
People.
Respect them, James.
80% of them are not bots.
They are as real as the day is long.
It's the fucking middle of winter, John. This is like literally the worst day you could have made that statement. This is iron sharpened steel all over again.
Hey.
All right. Anyway, science be damned on this episode, apparently. I don't think I actually made snarky comments at your expense, except that you weren't going to hear this, which
of
course. I was right.
Yeah,
so
you were absolutely
they weren't
correct.
Snarky. I thought the image would have enticed you. To at least go like, what the fuck did these idiots do? But no, All my efforts in vain.
That's the thing. I mean, I have a certain immunity to your images now, and they're just so ridiculous that
I put some effort in this one. I spent like an hour and a half on it. I had to make that Kong's hands into a baby doll. It was not as easy as you would think.
104 followers on Mastodon, James.
There we go. Number 104?
The record.
For the record.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's not 104 when this episode comes out, though. Hopefully it's at least 106. I need growth. We are a growth industry, John.
I put butts in the seats, James. Right? When people hear I'm coming back, it's like CM Punk coming back. It's like, you know, I'm a catalyst.
We're worried you're going to punch somebody in the backstage? Great. Awesome.
May happen.
Fucking great. Thanks, Pepsi Phil.
I guarantee nothing. You see this?
Right. We should have a podcast.
Crime Your River, James.
We should have a podcast.
It's Real Glass, Crime Your River.
Jesus fucking Christ. All right. Anyway, Guillaume is here.
Yeah, I was going to keep the Game Awards thing going, but then like we've wasted enough time just saying nothing. So
yeah,
just tell us more.
Yeah, Craig Leahy is also on this call.
Yo, hoi, hoi, everyone.
I like the implication that there are episodes we don't waste time doing nothing and that what we do is something on the regular basis. We're going to keep this episode relatively brief. Guillaume's got another engagement he needs to get to, which I believe that engagement is sleep.
Yep.
We're gonna do an email episode. This is largely driven by the fact that our new business was kind of all stuff that we could come back to later. But first, before I do that, I want to drop some news on these gentlemen. I am thinking within the next week, we are going to record our retroactive on the guest number 7. This is a very short game. Do you all think you can oblige this?
Yeah, there's enough FAQ files out there to go through every single puzzle.
I don't know. The microscope puzzle might not let itself be completed all that easily.
Yeah, this is true.
I have started it now, which is good because I couldn't say that last week, but now I have. Not gotten far, but I have started it. So, yeah, we're going to knock that out. So get your comments in. Where can you post your comments? Sean, where do you think they can post comments about the retroactive on the 7th guest?
In the NWR forums.
Okay. Where else?
Probably on Twitter or Mastodon, responding to the RFN podcast.
That's not what I had in mind, but sure, you could do that.
Something you're fishing for.
Discord, John. The Discord, sure.
See, I don't use Discord that much, so that's not really where I would probably go. But
okay, that's fine. The Discord. Yeah. Also, where else could they send us their thoughts on the game?
I don't know, RFN. RFN@worldreport.com. Man, stop grilling me. I just came back. Come on. RFN@NintendoWorldReport.com. They can also send us their thoughts there as well. I mean,
there we go.
Do we have a TikTok account? Because I can list that too.
Yeah, it's where I do all my dances.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah. I'm popping over here. Hey, update, Skull and Bone still exists.
I was going to say the same thing.
Who else has used RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com?
I don't know.
These people whose emails I just posted
yes,
in the chat.
Okay. All right. Yeah, sure. Yes, people that send emails to RFN. You say that like it's supposed to be
somebody notable. I got to say, this is a very unconventional way to host a podcast, James. I don't think this is all on John.
This is just interrogation, you know?
Hey, John, what number am I thinking of, John? Huh? Exactly. Jeez, you are in the mall, John.
Yo, exactly. What is my favorite color?
Yeah, what's my favorite color? John, how do I like my steak? You tell me. I'm like, all right, hello.
Alive.
Well done.
That is the answer. Teal.
You're definitely a well done guy.
Cocaine habit?
For sure.
No, I'm not a big steak guy, but...
I'm not asking that. I'm asking when you do have steak and the rare occasion upon which you do have steak, how do you like it? My prediction would maybe, maybe you're medium. Not medium rare.
Yeah.
Interesting.
No, not really.
Interesting.
But I was actually trying to transition us into email.
Really? You do it.
Which is the only segment we have today. Apparently, yes. I am the most prolific host the show has ever had, and therefore that must mean I am the highest quality. But I have changed my policy on counting. So we're going to go ahead and read the first email 30 minutes into the show. John, would you read the first email?
Certainly. Evan B. writes, "Hello, voices in my head. In the 2023 NWR Forum Awards thread, I saw Dave the Diver listed under the category for Best Independent Game. I furiously typed a response stating that the developer slash publisher Mint Rocket, being a subsidiary of Korean publisher Nexon, should not necessarily be considered an independent title. In a swift and brutal response, forum user MK Ultra stated that the famous Dorito King Keeley's The Game Awards themselves list Dave the Diver as an indie game. This should come as they no sure surprise, do. Seeing as they considered Sifu a fighting game last year. Now, I don't want to come across as a semantics-obsessed psychopath, but I was fairly certain indie developers are those who create games without the help of a major game publisher. For example, developers like WayForward that have worked with major publishers on specific products retain indie dev status through the release of original IP like Shantae. But does Risky's Revolution, which is being published thanks to the help of the sinisterly stupid limited run games, revoke the game's indie status? For Lon's sake..." I really like Lon Jindeman being invoked as a deity. That's really great. "Please help me make sense of this conundrum. What is indie? What is double A, pronounced double A? What is real? If anyone is qualified to give objectively correct labels to video game terminology, it's this group of men of leisure of which John Lindemann is occasionally a member. May your Jindemans be brary and might."
Wow. So before we tackle the whole like what is indie thing, I just want to say that I approve of forum beefs making their way into our mail.
I
think that it's a positive development. I just think that like if you're a semantics obsessed psychopath, the forums is the place for you. I invite all the semantics obsessed psychopaths to post more.
Did Evan B. just come into our inbox to respond, "I'm not owned, I'm not owned"? Is that what this is? Is he having a reaction to the man named after an illegal CIA experiment to engage in brainwashing in an email that starts to the voices in my head? Is this performance? Are they the same person? Are we getting Sarah from Iowa City'd by our own audience now? Is that what this is?
She's still out there. You know what? She's still out there, and she still has the same dreams, James.
Yes, No, she died in the flood, John. Remember?
Maybe not. Maybe God. That was a complete fake out. Maybe she wanted us to think that she was dead. You ever considered
that?
She
did not.
Have they compared her dental records?
Yeah, that's
right. That's probably the worst prank in RFN history, because the fucking city had a flood the week after we played it. It was like, God damn it! Of all the cities on Earth, the one we used. So here's the answer, and it's not going to be satisfying for any of the players involved.
Oh, good.
All these words are made up and don't mean anything.
Hmm.
All words are fake. You could say whatever you splorge.
Well, I think at a certain point they get co-opted, right? You see this in the music industry too, where you have labels that are truly independent, but then eventually the major labels start making little subsidiary labels and claim they're independent just to look independent, but they're really not.
Or they buy one of these independent labels but don't put their name on it.
Yeah. And they, become...
Would you consider Death Row to still be independent?
Not really.
I guess technically, yes, because they're not part of the main studio.
They were backed by Interscope, for crying out loud. Right?
Yeah.
Like, Interscope is like Clive Davis massive, right? Or not Clive Davis.
I mean, you're not wrong.
Yeah.
Also, they were founded by, like, a massive fucking criminal.
Yes.
Hold on. Before I say anything else, is he still in prison? Oh, yes, he's still in prison. Okay, we can talk about him. Okay, I had to be sure.
Your friend Suge Knight might hang out the window.
Are you saying he wouldn't?
What?
You don't have to be famous to have a beef with him. He doesn't give a shit.
That's true. But yeah, I mean, I think
so. Basically, what we're saying is that the indie name is not like controlled. Anyone can say that they're indie. Like, there's no verification. Yeah. There's no. It's a little bit like that reporting that I saw recently about cheeses, about how artisan cheese can be like a big company with the same equipment can just make cheese and label it like artisanal. But then, so the like farmers came up with like, well, it's directly from the farmer. This one is, you know, a farmer's cheese. Mm-hmm. So basically, mm-hmm. this is the situation. We've got like a farmer's game here.
Well, I mean, of course, the implication of that is that cheese produced by a large brand also didn't. It's like, it's not like they synthetically created the milk. Like, there was still a cow on a farm somewhere.
Somebody started talking about cheese. Having a serious discussion about cheese.
It got very provincial French in here for a minute. We're gonna backpedal a little bit on that one and talk about wine. No, I mean, you're right though. Like, so there is independent in film basically used to mean this is no longer relevant. It used to mean, I think it was the big three studios at that point, and then it became the big four. But there were basically three big Hollywood studios, and everybody else, if you weren't part of their system, you were considered independent. And that was a really easy metric to follow. Are you in a company that is owned by one of those companies? No? Okay. Then you're independent. Great. Done. But the reality of the situation is, since then, there have been more companies that have come into play that aren't part of those systems, but they're still big. They're still very large companies. And what is the value we place on the term independent beyond just describing the business infrastructure? Dave the Diver's not an independent game. It is a third party game. That's it. I mean, it is what it is. Now I understand how it got that titling, because it very much feels like the kind of game a small studio would have released on Steam. Independent, there's the origin of that term, of a larger corporate interest. But even then, you know, they might have had a publisher who was backing them.
Yeah,
but this is a wholly owned studio.
Yeah, I mean, wholly owned studio by who? Who owns them? Because I think to me that's probably the dividing line, right? Like if you're talking like first party, second party, Nexon. Third party. I mean, if they're owned by Nexon's
huge.
Yeah, if they're owned by Nexon, they're not really independent. They're not.
No.
You know, they would be a second party, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe third party.
If you want to use the term second, but they'd be second party to Nexon.
Yes.
But they're
yes,
but I mean,
exactly.
Really, it depends on their ownership situation. Like, if they're fully owned by Nexon, they're not even second party. They're just part of Nexon.
They're just a subsidiary.
Yeah. And like, that's fine. Like, there's nothing inherently bad about that. Now, is Nexon any? So I am on Mint Rocket's website right now, mm-hmm. and they don't mention Nexon much, except for the fact that the copyright is Nexon Korea Corporation, all rights reserved. There is no Mint Rocket copyright at all. It is just Nexon, not for the game, for the everything. So yeah, they're fully owned. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, they do appear to be running semi-autonomously. Like, they've got their own press team. They've got their own press contacts. But everything has copyright Nexon at the bottom of the screen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they are a fully dependent internal studio owned by Nexon, who is not the kind of organization that you would say is indie.
Yeah, I mean, right here.
Nexon's fucking huge.
Yeah, in May 2022, Nexon announced the launch of Mint Rocket, a sub-brand and division of Nexon.
Yeah.
That specializes on games focusing on the essence of fun. Yes. So they are not an independent studio. I mean, they are literally a division of Nexon.
Yes, exactly.
That is probably kind of... getting the rub of people assuming that they're an independent developer.
Oh, yeah. And that's, you know, that them being named in for these awards is, you know, not correct. It should not have happened, but that's just kind of the way it goes. I mean, Nexon pulled down, all right, Johnny, I've converted it to USDs. They list their money as yens because yen, even though they were formed in South Korea, they corporate migrated to Tokyo at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So there's essentially like, there is still a large Korean branch though. What do you think their operating revenue was in 2021?
Mint Rocket?
No, Nexon.
Oh, Nexon is, oh my God. They're huge. They have USDs. They have so many games. Their revenue? I don't know, 200 yeah. million? Something like that.
$2 billion.
Holy shit. Wow.
So yeah, this is not an indie game.
No.
It's not.
Not even close.
But if you look at Day of the Diver, I can see how you would get there. And so yeah. I would say its inclusion in the Game Awards, like I'm not going to say it was paid for. Like that would be, I don't know that. And so to say that would be inappropriate. But I do know there are marketing deals here. There are, and with any award platform, there's a nominating process. And people put forward their product to be nominated. And so I would guess that there probably is a structure in place around the Game Awards for nominations, and Day of the Diver got put up. And either the validation of is this actually an indie game wasn't done, or wasn't done to any kind of exhaustive degree, or just wasn't important to them. And they weren't so concerned with like, we should protect the purity of the term indie game. Because Day of the Diver is really good and they wanted to include it, and it's not likely to win an award in any other category. And they're like, yeah, this is a good enough place for it.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess you could look at that. Maybe that team, they consider it independent just because it's not supervised that much by Nexon.
Sure. But it's not like if you're using it for like independent studio, it's not like it's
not. Yeah.
But like when
it's
you
absolutely
get,
not.
You get to like, what's double A? Like we talk about like, the end of the double A. What happened to the double A games? And it's kind of a term that doesn't really have meaning because it just means not triple A, but also not indie game. But, you know, Day of the Diver is not a double A game. Like it's complicated. There's a lot of stuff in it, but from a production standpoint, it ain't that. So what do you call it? Like, I don't know. I call it a game that looks like an indie game, but isn't.
It's sort of like 2.5D.
Yeah. I mean, it's a 2D game that's pixel art, and it's a roguelite.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying like 2.5D as a term was kind of developed
right.
You know what I'm saying? As almost like a mishmash. People didn't know what to classify some of those games as. So they're like, it's not 2D. It's not 3D. It's 2.5D. You know,
right.
Which I guess is double
like,
A
you don't
in
move
and of itself.
Yeah. 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 It's like, so it goes back to my opening statement on this, which is what I said was going to be unsatisfying to everybody, which is these words don't have any meaning. Like there are certain things that have meaning where you can say just definitively, like, this is that. Like this word has a meaning and I can use it and feel confident that I am correctly describing this thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, AAA games, broadly speaking, you can look at them and go like, yeah, I can eyeball test that and go, yeah, that looks like a AAA game.
Yeah, but Dave the Diver as an independent game, yes, that is a sham and a travesty.
I wouldn't go that far because I think that game is really cool. But yeah, I would be upset if another game lost out on the opportunity to get recognized because of that. But did... counter to that is if it's not in that category, it won't have a chance to get recognized anywhere else.
This is true.
Because it's not big enough to survive in a category with things like, I don't even know what combat they'd put or category they'd put it in, like the one with Ace Combat and Mario at the same fucking time. I don't know. Fuck,
yeah.
Who gives a shit?
Yeah.
Like there's just like the categorization of this, and I could say this because I did our awards for, what do you think, John? Did it for about 4 years?
Yeah.
Like the categorization a lot of times was just fuck it, I don't know. So we'd have like, what's the best party game? And I'm like, shit, is this a party game?
Yeah,
I guess.
You know, this like the independent game category feels like it really should be renamed to quirky small team game. Like
yeah,
best
quirky
small team game.
Right. Because it feels like that's what they're going for.
Yeah.
But then
that's
things like House House, who made Goose Game, who showed their next game.
Yes.
Which I think it's called something like, what was it, like Long Walk or something?
Yeah.
That looks very much larger than quirky small studio game. Like, it looks like a much more involved product. But it's still going to be an independent game because they are who they are. So I don't know. Now the question of what does it happen when a outside party heavily boosts or funds the development of a game from an independent studio? Is it still an indie game?
Yeah.
And my answer is I don't know.
Yeah.
Like maybe? Sorta? Like
I mean,
it comes down to like how do I feel about it?
Well, I mean, Microsoft never owned Bungie, but yet they contributed significant funds to the making of Halo. Is Halo an independent game?
Is Halo
no.
an indie game? Halo's an indie game.
Yeah,
Halo is a small indie project.
It is. It is a quirky small team game.
I mean, which Halo are we talking about? Because that's true for at least one of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first one.
It's a quirky large team game. Most recently,
yeah.
It's tough. It's difficult. You know, putting things in buckets sometimes is too difficult and too impossible to justify whatever advantage it gives you for having done it. I would say for the purposes, if the purpose of that award is to recognize work being done outside of, you know, major studios by teams who are putting their own financial future at risk to make this game or whatever. Like, if you're going for that kind of romanticism, which there is some of that in the whole idea of the indie game, then yeah, I would be somewhat annoyed if a game like Dave the Diver cost a game like that the opportunity to be recognized and potentially make a bunch of money on that recognition. But if it's just to recognize, like John called it, small quirky games, I guess it fits. But nobody's going to come out and say, like, well, our intention really is to go after small team quirky games. Because it sort of puts a big label on stuff that people who receive that label may not appreciate. I don't know. Like,
yeah.
Guillaume, Greg, are you?
I don't know. I'm still thinking about cheese.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought you were thinking about foreign beefs.
Guillaume prefers his game. His game's artisanal.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Do you like your foreign beefs well done?
Wait, what?
Do you like your foreign beef well done?
Foreign
sure.
beefs. I like them rare.
Well,
these days.
I
used to like them well done, but...
I gave up foreign beefs a while ago, but I guess I kind of
it's
missed
bad
them.
For your heart.
Yeah, it is.
It's bad for your heart.
Yeah, I mean, the Wii is not...
John wants his foreign beef to be bloody.
The Wii is not for serious gamers, James. We know that from the NWR forums. I stated it years
ago. We know that from you in 2009 on this show.
Years ago, I told you. You know, I
With
hold it to
irony
this day.
In your voice than is there now.
And I guess, like, ultimately, to be a little bit more serious for a second, there's
How
not
dare
that
you.
Much. Yeah, I'm sorry. There's not. I don't know what this there to gain with the labels of indie or not these days, because I feel like all the more and more like games are ported and are playable on the subsequent hardware. And so, like, new games are competing with old games. And as I'm playing through the Castlevania games, those were not indie games. But so, what is, like, the only difference between, a game made by a small team today and those games is that they were made by relatively bigger teams from a big publisher, but they're old. and they inspired those games that I'm, you know, you can also play, like those Metroidvanias that, you know, were inspired by them. Anyway, I guess is what I'm saying is that it all kind of blurs, right? Like, if you're, I don't know what there is to be gained by, focusing on those labels, and like it, they would be indistinguishable, basically, is what I'm saying. Like, if you put, you know, Symphony of the Night and some other game inspired by it next to each other, what is there to be gained by labeling one indie and the other not? I don't know. Sorry, yeah. I'm rambling. I mean, this is not a fruitful conversation at all. Anyway.
Wow. Way to devalue the last 10 minutes of the show, Guillaume. Jeez.
I'm sorry.
No, but I think you're more or less, with the exception of the weird nihilism at the end, I think you're more or less there. Like, it doesn't... It's... There is a value in finding space to recognize games that are not going to have the budget of some of these giant games. Because you can, and we've talked about this in the show in the past, I think this is a germane point to bring up again, is that, broadly speaking, barring tremendous mismanagement, if I throw enough production value at my game, it should be at a baseline level acceptable. And, like, have things to recommend it. If I drop enough money on my product, if I invest enough in the game, like, there should be a baseline level of quality and visuals and gameplay and sound that game delivers, regardless of, you know, the overall value proposition of my product. And regardless of if this is a strong financial decision or not, like, there should be... The game should have at least a decent quality coming out of a major investment. Just because a lot of these things have been commoditized, and you can spend your way into your game not having shitty controls and having decent visuals and having good art and having, you know, good music and sound and technical proficiency. But, you know, if you're a small team, you can't do that. So you can't have, you know, luscious 3D backgrounds that can be interacted with. You ain't got the budget for that. You gotta hone in on an idea. And so that's where, like, I'm more amenable to Dave the Diver being there, is it does hone in on an idea. Dave the Diver hones in on a few ideas. And I don't even want to talk about that game on the show because I was constantly being surprised by it. But in that respect, it does compare very much to, what's a good example? I don't know. I was trying to think of what a good example of a game would be. Like, what's the Harvest Moon knockoff that became bigger than Harvest Moon?
Stardew Valley.
Yeah, it does compare to Stardew Valley and how it just keeps adding, you know, gameplay stuff as it goes and becomes not quite the game you believed it to be when you started. And that's neat, and I like that. And it wouldn't compare in a category with the billion-dollar games. I say $1 billion, and I'm being somewhat facetious, but let's say a $200 million production. Because I can tell you right now, Dave Diver ain't that. And movies, we used to do this too, but lately, because of the commoditization of the technology, the advancements in nonlinear editing, the ability to generate effects and graphics and special effects, different than effects. Commoditization of lighting, camera quality has become sort of available to the masses. You could produce a movie for $2 or $3 million, which I know, you know, to our brain is a lot of money, but for a movie, it's fucking nothing. And it be competitive with a $65 million Oscar bait film in award season. It's not the same in games. And so I get it. It's the answer here is you can go tell MK Ultra where to stuff his mind altering drugs. But like it's probably not a fruitful argument I agree. Mm-hmm. It probably shouldn't have been nominated in the Game Awards, but I don't know where else they would have put it. And that was probably their ultimate concession.
Right. Well, I don't know. Like, you try to put these games into their little genre, their little box, but a lot of them take so many, you know, inspirations from so many different places, and like you end up with ridiculous stuff, like best puzzle game, God of War or something. And it's like, wait, what?
God willing.
Yeah.
Best kart racing game, God of War. I'm here. I'm ready.
Sure.
Make it happen.
But so it's a similar situation. What
do we used to call it, John? Parlor games? Was the old NWR the NWR genre? It was like party or parlor games.
Parlor games.
What the fuck was that title? What did that even mean?
Yeah. Like
games I say
you,
this as somebody who's
say you
as-
play in the parlor, which could be literally anything, pretty much.
I say this as somebody who's been a staff member of the site for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
That when I would talk to other staff members of the site, I could just say, oh, that's a parlor game. And it would just immediately crack them up because we all knew. We all knew what that genre didn't mean a goddamn thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same, but it's similar.
Yeah. It's kind of a like, yeah, this is a game that your grandmother would play. Pretty much.
Backgammon.
Yes.
We're going to have backgammon. What's the best backgammon game of 2023, John?
Yeah, I don't know, but damn it, I'm going to find out.
Is the best parlor game of 2023 Mahjong Souls? They put gacha mechanics in Mahjong.
Oh, God. Oh, it was about time. Long overdue.
It is. I'm ready. I'm ready for it. All right. Ready for the next email?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Greg, would you want to read the next email?
Sure. DJ writes, hello RFN. A fair amount of people are getting excited at the thought of the Zelda movie coming out next, but I actually think Star Fox could be a better follow-up to the Mario movie. The visuals could be stellar, the story is basic enough to allow for a studio to put their spin on it, and most importantly, it's an IP that Nintendo has no qualms about lending out. So my question is as such, which company has handled Star Fox the best over the years? Rare with Star Fox Adventures, Namco with Assault, Platinum with Zero, Ubisoft with Starlink? Also, which film studio would you like to see work on a possible Star Fox film? As always, yours is the best podcast on the internet. He is hoping Konami does fulfill Greg's wishes and give us a Gunbari Goemon anthology. I naturally agree.
I also would like that. All right, so...
It's a few things. We still haven't really talked about the Zelda thing on air.
I'm fucking like, they're making a live action Zelda movie. The director said he wants to make it a live action Miyazaki film, which fucking fails at like a it's a contradiction of terms right out of the gate. Like, Miyazaki's fundamental raison d'etre is that you can't do this in film. It has to be hand drawn. That's his thing. That's his like ethos. Like, he finally made a movie with CG in it just to learn it at like 800 years old. It's like, God, it just shows, like, I have no idea what I'm talking about. Which, yeah, I'm not... That movie's going to be fucking awful. It's going to be fucking awful. Like, there's no reason that should be live action. But we're here, so get ready, boys. They're making a live action. I can't remember who the director was now.
I believe his name is Wes Ball. I have not seen any of his things. The lot of Maze Runner... movies or something.
It was the guy that did the Maze Runner game.
I'm not familiar with that franchise myself. Apparently he's doing the next Planet of the Apes film, which will be coming out next year. So preceding ones, the sort of Andy Serkis led ones, I quite like those, but that we have no idea whether this one will be, you know, particularly great or anything. I think at least the latter one of the maybe the latter two or one of those was by Matt Reeves, who's gone gone on to do, you know, the Batman, and so forth. So, you know, like, they were pretty good, but, you know, there's a very definite kind of ending to those three films. So, you know, a time has passed. So I don't know that it necessarily suggests anything about, how capable he's going to be. And then, you know, at that, and then Zelda is, you know, something quite different again. I just would have thought the abstraction of animation would have been very useful when you're dealing with something, you know, coming from a video game where, you know, again, you've got some of the same issues as there were adapting Mario, but it's probably more complex. In Zelda's case, I would have thought animation, you know, it's a bit demeaning to call it a crutch, but, you know, like that, I think it would have been a helpful thing to kind of say, okay, you know, yes, we're bringing this world to life in a way that it has not been brought to life before, but it's not the really heavy lift of like, oh no, and we're doing it, you know, like quote unquote live action. There would still be a great deal of, you know, computer graphics in it, of course, but, you know, with photorealism being the aim, I think they've made it harder for themselves to deliver something that people will be able to kind of endorse or get behind. And it's always difficult with a character like Link, or even some of the other characters, you know, where the kind of storytelling they've had in the past, which is quite, you know, limited, you know, not very, first, you know, not very plot heavy, you know, for instance. I mean, you had a question when I was away, you know, however many weeks ago, about, oh, you know, what like some of the really good Nintendo games, you know, featuring like a significant amount of plot, or, you know, that are actually plot based. And that's the thing. I mean, even Nintendo games that I would say are quite narratively successful still demonstrate a sort of aversion to plot, you know, in terms of like, actually, okay, not so much what's the broad sweep of the story of, you know, it's about this character in this world and ultimately this thing is going to happen, but it's about, you know, where we're talking about how do these things happen, how does one thing lead to another, and, you know, the sequencing and the sort of rationale between how the steps of the story play out. They avoid that like the plague, basically.
Oh, yes.
You know, they're desperate to not have to deal with all that. You know, and that's the thing is, you know, sort of like, you know, something like Tears of the Kingdom or Breath of the Wild before it. I think they have narrative strengths, you know, things that add to the experience, but it's so, and you talked about this, you know, when I was away quite a lot, you know, a lot of it's in the world building or the lore or the, you know, things that you could kind of infer about the world of the game from, you know, the environment or the other little details and this, that, the, but very seldom is it about, you know, okay, you know, here's like these characters having dialogue and that drives the story forward and we understand why and one thing leads to another. These are things you can't run from especially in a live action film. Cause again, I think just our animation, obviously, it's a lot of the same challenges, but that layer of abstraction, I think gives you a little bit more leeway about like, does everything have to like clearly logically follow, you know, this progression of the plot, the way that live action, I think, will probably demand, you know, the way that the audience responds to it. So I think they've set themselves, yeah, a really difficult situation and with a character like Link in particular that's been so loosely defined. He's looked different, he's been different ages, he doesn't talk, you know, everybody's got their own Link in their head, right? As some version of, you know,
even other characters in the world have their own version of Link in their head. Like that's one of the running gags of the series, is that pretty much everybody just kind of treats him however they want him to be. You can see that a lot in Breath of the Wild. It's bonkers.
Yeah. So the point is that once it funnels down to, okay, here he is, he's in live action, he's talking, it's just, there's no way that it's going to be like you're met with that much warmth from a lot of people, because it's just going to be, well, that's not my link, is it? You know, that's you know, you've seen a little bit of this just within, you know, games with like giving Samus, you know, the internal monologue in Other M, and some of it's just because it's poorly executed. There's no getting around that. It was sure. Just like, I don't know how well written it was in the first place, but the sort of very seemingly kind of direct, like functional localization of the writing didn't do it any, you know, kind of favors. And also, so it wasn't that good in the first place. But also, even if it'd been better, I think a lot of people are like, this is not, it's not how I kind of imagined Samus. Because again, Samus was just this nebulous thing of, she's just like, oh, you know, she's kind of like Boba Fett. She's a badass. You know, she could do like virtually anything. She becomes a god by the end of most of these games. Like, you feel a lot of it in yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I remember there was this weird undercurrent of people who were like, why should she be scared of Ridley, or why should she be traumatized by Ridley? It's like, well, isn't the whole premise that he basically killed her entire family and colony as a child and she watched it? Like, yeah, she should be traumatized.
No, that is emblematic, and I'm sure we've mentioned this before, but just quickly, that is emblematic of one of the main problems about Other M, in that it tries to kind of have its cake and eat it, in that it tries to be within the existing Metroid canon and say, oh no, this is a, you know, after Super Metroid, but before Metroid Fusion, and it fits. But then on the other hand, it was really like no, this is a scene that clearly, I think it's literally in, essentially, one of the Sakamoto kind of approved Metroid mangas, right? Where it's like, no, this is a scene that happened to Samus, like, the first time she encountered Ridley. It would not be something that would have happened to her after she's killed him multiple times.
I don't know. If he kept coming back, I might be more freaked out.
No, you know what
How
I mean?
How do you keep coming back?
The whole thing is basically like a remake of Fusion, but he didn't actually want it to be a remake. So it's like, oh, no, well, this is Flesh and Blood Adam Malkovich, as opposed to, you know, Computer Adam Malkovich, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's just, yeah, it would have been better off probably just like being entirely separate from the existing canon. And so he could do all these like bits and pieces of the Metroid lore, you know, that he'd envisioned before. Putting them, you know, as part of this already existed story just didn't, yeah, that didn't really work. So yeah, it's like the whole, I understand that sort of scene as something that would make sense for Samus at some point, but it doesn't make much sense, you know, in that place in the timeline.
I just don't think people want these characters humanized as much as they say they might.
No, but a lot of people don't. Again, there's something to be said for just like, you know, this, you've just got this kind of, you know, general sense of a character, and you could kind of, you know, imbue it with whatever you like.
Extent. Link being the kind of silent protagonist is one of the appeals of the series,
well, and
in
also
my opinion.
Just like, you know, he's called Link because it's, and you could name him whatever you want until the recent games where they make you call him Link. Because it was meant to be you're going, he's just there in your stead. And, you know, I always kind of thought, to be honest, they should give you more customization options over Link as a result of that, because it's like, well, no, if he's meant to be me, then let's have more of us. But now it's like, well, in some ways you do have more customization options because he can look whatever the hell you want him to look like, it based on, you know, what kind of gear he's going to end up wearing. And that does have, you know, impact on his stats and stuff. But no, you can't call him anything. And I guess that lets them, you know, have purer call him Linky, and other people give him like nicknames and stuff. But yeah, it sort of kind of struck me as a strange choice. But the point is, of all of it, is just like, yeah, there's it's going to be so hard for people to just be like, I can't accept this specific person with a specific characterization as the same Link that I've been, you know, thinking of and carrying with me for however many years.
Well, and the challenge with film, broadly speaking, is it's very hard to write timelessly, if that makes sense. So whatever they do with Link is going to feel very of its moment. That's just the way movies are right now. We're coming out of, thank God, we're coming out of the Avengers writing arc. where everybody's like, ah, I'm going to have snappy dialogue between characters who are kind of...
Yeah,
kind
of, everything is just so snarky and so wink, wink, nudge, nudge, yeah. Like, I'm so over that.
I got that reference, John. We're finally getting past the weird memification of our writing, but that doesn't mean that we're not going to be just falling into another pit of that. And like, I don't want to see Link like that. That's not what I expect Link to be. Like, Link's sort of only defining characteristic is that he is consistently highly motivated, and oftentimes for no good reason. Like, he's motivated in a way that's just like, you shouldn't be motivated.
He's supernaturally brave. That's really the most tangible. He literally has a divine sort of attachment to the attribute of courage.
courage beyond foolishness. The character who has a supernatural connection to wisdom in Wind Waker basically says... basically says your bravery is stupid and suicidal, but I'll put you in a cannon. Screw it. Let's go. I actually think animation would have really benefited this movie in a lot of ways, but we talk about the characterization and being able to create visual separation and to remove the audience from like being able to try to tie things directly to the real world because you've drawn it and you could put fancifulness into it and you could put artifice in there, like deliberate artifice that creates that wall of separation. You can also do simpler characterization in animation because the people have that artifice in place. With actual actors on screen, they expect a certain amount of organicness out of them. But with animation, you can do whatever the fuck you want. But a place where it's going to actually be an issue is combat. So you can do a lot of very good, very interesting, very nice looking swordplay combat against fantastical foes in an animated setting, and it looked good. But with live action, you can go look at like Lord of the Rings. This is an Academy Award winning film in Return of the King, Best Picture. The swordplay stuff, nominally speaking, doesn't look very good. It's a lot of times it's Aragorn swinging a sword around in the dark, getting rained on in the mud. And it's like,
yeah, but then sometimes like they just like throw a sword, or like you've got Legolas just grinding his way down.
The Legolas. I really didn't like the Legolas stuff that just got more and more ridiculous.
My recent rewatch, it was some of the most joy I was getting from those movies.
But in an animated construct, that would be fine because the artifice there is.
I think it's exactly what James is talking about. It's like him sort of sliding down the trunk of the Mummerkill after he's just like one shotted this gigantic walking fortress. Probably would have accepted that in animation much more. In live action, it's kind of like this is more dumb than it is cool.
But you could do all kinds of fun flourishes in animation too. Like, you could slow it down, you could have a nice free, like if you think about in the Breath of the Wild trailer, that first one we got with action when Link pulled back the ancient arrow and there was that freeze. And then we didn't see the arrow fly. We just saw the hit with the blue energy explosion. So that basically we lost the time between arrow release and its flight. Like, you could do that in animation, but in live action, it just looks stupid. It looks like something out of a Fast and Furious movie. It just looks dumb. And so you can't get away. It looks like something out of the Hobbit films. To go back to the reference, where all the action looks stupid in every scene. There's not a single good action scene in The Hobbit. And look, Peter Jackson is a very good director. This guy was working on the special features of the Star Trek movies back in 2009. I'm just saying...
Yeah,
the combat's probably gonna look like
now
crap.
I wish that we were getting Peter Jackson's The Legend of Zelda. Like, I don't know. Like, when I rewatched the Lord of the Rings movies recently, they are stupid. It's not just Legolas. Like, every time that there's a fucking orc on screen, it has to just go like. you know, just like make a face and like it's so cartoony, it's so silly, but like every time it made us laugh. And there's some of that in Zelda. Like I just noticed Tears of the Kingdom, the Princess.
I mean it's funny. I just watched Peter Jackson's King Kong, and he does have a style where like you look at that and you're like, wow, this is just like the Lord of the Rings movies, just in terms of the way the shots, the camera movements, the way the characters act, all of that stuff. It's like definitely a style.
Weta developed those tools and they put them to use.
Yes.
Oh, so like with that kind of, and like just the right amount of cheese, basically, in his movies.
Look at his early stuff. It's full of cheese.
His early stuff is just like splatter movies and stuff. Brain dead, bad taste.
Like I feel like a Legend of Zelda movie where they tried to play it too serious would be super boring. Now I kind of want that kind of spirit where, like, yes, you do have Link surf on a shield, shooting arrows, and just, you know, have a little bit of a clumsy badass moment.
Yeah. I kind of want grimdark Link. I want alcoholic Link. I want alcoholic divorce Link.
So that Dungeons and Dragons all of that, movie
I
that
think
came
the
out.
Point is all of that would play better in animation, but you know, we're not getting it. So there's that. But I think it doesn't. I wouldn't say I'm ready to say there's no way it's going to be something that could be considered a success. And ultimately, you know, it's monetary performance and how it lands, you know, with people who are not that invested in Zelda is going to be much more important for this than, you know, what our opinion is. So that'll be a lot of it in the end. But, and even like I said, I'm not entirely giving up, because it's just, I'm not even familiar with the director's work. They're really early in it. You know, I don't think they've even really got a script yet, you know, so they've announced it, but they've been talking about how it's being financed, how it'd be distributed and all that kind of thing. But it's just the real basics. So there's
ink on a contract right now.
Yeah. It's a long, long way to go, before it's something on screen. But I do think, it'll be a challenge. And so in that sense, I don't disagree with the content of the email that sort of suggests, hey, you know what? I would have been baffled, but I would have been more like, oh, maybe this could work about a Star Fox movie.
it's looseness. The fact that it's not a franchise they put a ton of value on would have made it easier to produce, but it also obviously would have made it less of a box office draw.
You feel like goodness knows how many successful Nintendo screen adaptations there'll have to be before Star Fox becomes, you know, it's like, again, with the Marvel stuff, right? It's like, eventually they've got to some relatively like obscure characters, in that, but only once it became this immensely sprawling thing that was covering TV series and, you know, that already had many, many films and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's not something I'd ever consider particularly plausible. But if in terms of, like, what would I want from stuff, I would want the Wes Anderson stop motion animation type of look, you know, Isle of Dogs, Fantastic Mr. Fox, do that for Star Fox. That would be pretty awesome.
So that's actually really good. So, if you're still syncing with the Game Awards, Zelda just won their best action game. So I thought that was an interesting timing here. I actually thought the Henson Studio would do well here. And they've already, you know, played with this franchise, but I don't mean like the Muppets. I mean like Dark Crystal kind of style of their puppetry work. The stuff that Disney didn't buy. So, cause Disney bought the Muppets more so than the company. Like I think that doing that in a space setting with all the kinds of goofy characters they could come up with that they could just fill in puppetry. And Greg, you kind of, and I were in the same sort of space here. I think it would be real, like in a movie that has no human actors in it. No CG characters. Everything is a puppet, but done like to the most extreme, hide the artifice, but embrace the artifice way of doing it, where it's like you don't see visible strings and shit. This isn't the fucking Thunderbirds.
Although Thunderbirds is like an inspiration for Star Fox, right?
Yeah, so exactly.
It's kind of like
I know.
But not you're not making it like you're making the Thunderbirds in the 60s or whatever.
Yeah, unless you do it like Thunderbirds or Go, if anybody saw that, which is kind of it's a weird mix of live action, not live action, but models and CGI. It's weird.
Yeah, it felt like weird. It missed the plot a little bit.
Yeah.
But like I would say as little CG as they could manage, like as much practical effects as you can do.
Again, like the new Dark Crystal series, I guess, would be a kind of interesting reference point because that was a lot of puppets. Again, they're trying to recreate that world that was all puppets back in the early 80s, but they use CG to kind of augment it, obviously, and then to do some kind of shots that they just wouldn't have been able to do before. But yeah, ideally kind of keep it as practical as possible. Like, almost have, that's why I mentioned the Wes Anderson style is because this is something, it's really beautiful to look at. It's a great stop motion animation, but there's something intentionally like lo-fi about it as well. It's got, goes for like this kind of homemade, handmade kind of look at type for like certain kinds of effects that it does. I think applying that to a sci-fi scenario, I think would be, you know, kind of an amusing twist on it, you know, because like I said, obviously those two movies you don't have that, but like, you know, almost like it's, you know, kids are making their own like sci-fi space drama, you know, in their room or something, but it just actually looks way better than that could ever look.
Yeah, it's almost like toys that have the felt covering on them. I can't remember what those are called. But moving on their own. It's kind of it's very distinct as well. Almost it might almost be too distinct for Nintendo's taste though. Like it would be more a Wes Anderson film than it would be a Nintendo film, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the thing. It doesn't seem like they're, you know, because again, I mean, there are. I still haven't seen the Mario movie. Got to put that up. But you know, like the Mario movie's animation style could have been way more distinctive. It could have been way more individual. You know, it could have been hand drawn. They went for something that was just basically what do CG movies for kids look like now. I'm sure it has some of its own flourish and personality and stuff, but broadly speaking, it's like they didn't want to alienate anyone. They wanted something that looked like a mainstream animated movie today, and making Zelda live action is, you know, kind of in that spirit too. So yeah, on top of just the general implausibility of Star Fox getting adapted onto the screen at all, the idea that it'd ever look anywhere near as distinct as something from, you know, the Henson Workshop, or especially the Wes Anderson stop motion animated films, is pretty fanciful, but we may as well indulge it here because it won't be anywhere else.
I'm trying to remember, what's the studio that made Chicken Run and such?
Aardman. So Wallace and Gromit, all that kind of stuff.
I want claymation Star Fox. That's what we need. Just plasticine Star Fox everywhere. Lord. All right, John, who's your studio? Who's making your Star Fox movie?
I was really thinking, you know, kind of doing a better job, but whatever studio made Thunderbirds or Go, I would think.
Okay.
Would be pretty good. Just not as much, like you said, not as much weird plasticky CGI. Advocate for going almost like old school Thunderbirds style, like with better, I wouldn't even mind seeing strings. Honestly, I think that'd be kind of cool. Just for the hell of
it. I could see doing it if you're like, this is, Weta worked on that movie. Really?
Yeah.
I'm dumbfounded. Gil, what about you? Who's producing your Star Fox movie?
My problem with like the Jim Henson suggestion is that I find the Dark Crystal really, really boring. But then again, it's from the 80s, right? So
yeah, I
wish that there was something more recent. Well, I haven't. Yeah, there is something more recent. It was in Netflix
series
that I didn't watch. Yeah, but anyway, so I was thinking like, well, if we're gonna go to like such an old like franchise or comparison, might as well go with the 90s where the in my mind, the movies were a little bit better than the 80s. And so,
okay. Whoever, Cobra disagrees.
I guess it was, was it the Disney movie Homeward Bound?
Yeah, with the animals that just run, yeah. Which is a remake of a 70s movie.
So why not go full,
talk?
You know, yeah. That No, they do talk, right? Like, or they no, and they don't it, mouth the, it. Like, they didn't put peanut butter in the mouths of these poor animals.
Homeward Bound is a remake of a 70s Disney movie, which is the same premise, but the animals don't talk in that movie.
Okay. Well, I'm thinking of the one where they do talk. So let's have like actual foxes and falcons just, you know, being shot like, whatever. Like, let's have them have a little adventure. I feel like, you know, like the new like Lion King remake lost an opportunity, you know, to make such a movie using real lions and stuff. So let's do it for Star Fox. You know, let's have the courage to point a camera at a bunch of pets and animals and hope that they do what you want them to do.
So there was a movie that came out. I can't remember what it was called. That Roar 81. It was shot with real live predatory cats with the actors. It's fine though. Only half the cast was mauled, including Melanie Griffith, who received 50 stitches after being. And feared she was going to lose an eye after being grabbed by a lion in the middle of the shoot.
Nice.
So yeah, I think this is right. I think you're right. I think we need to have like alive animals and then just dress them up in costumes.
Do it real. Like, you know, make it for real.
Make it for real. Yep. We didn't answer the first part of his question. Oh, yes. We didn't answer the first part of the question. Is what studio has treated Star Fox the best?
Yep, and it's the one that isn't mentioned, isn't it? So we get Rare, we get Namco, we get Platinum, we get Ubisoft, but the actual answer is Q Games, said by Dylan Cuthbert, who handled Star Fox Command and Star Fox 64 3D, because of course, you know, Dylan goes back to the developers who made the original Star Fox as well within Nintendo. He came over from the UK, having worked at Argonaut, as a number of people went with him to work on that and stuff. So yeah, it's pretty hard to, if we just say, well, we can't just say Nintendo internal for like, you know, Star Fox 64 or whatever, then yeah, I think that has to be the next in line. And not that, you know, as I said last week, I do enjoy Star Fox Zero and still haven't played Star Fox Assault. I haven't got around to that, and there hasn't been a re-release for me to easily kind of do it. So maybe, you know, Namco did a decent job. I don't know, even though it wasn't that well thought of at the time.
Yeah, well, the problem was mostly the controls, I think. Like, it didn't go for that very quickly standard dual, you know, analog Halo scheme. And so, like, it's kind of, when you switch from being in the ship and on foot, like, it's a little bit like you have to, it's a little bit like tapping your head and, you know, rubbing your belly at the same time. It's like you have to relearn the control scheme that doesn't feel natural at all. But also, I think that the flying segments were not all that great either, just taken on their own. So, personally, I would go with Platinum. I like Star Fox Zero enough, but I don't know, that the bar is still pretty low there. You know, I feel like someone could have, but like they kind of had their hands tied behind their backs with the request that, you know, they had from Nintendo, which was to use the gamepad for aiming and stuff, which I enjoyed. Like, I actually, like, in some very brief moments in that game, it worked well. But most of the time it didn't, you know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's Command is weird because if you think back on it, you're like, oh, but it's made by the Ace Combat team. It should have been good. It's made by the Ace Combat 2 team before the series had its, like, great Genesis in 3. So it's like, ah, fuck. They could have probably made such a better game if they had made it, like, 5 years later.
Yeah, and that's Assault, right?
You said Command, but yeah.
Assault, sorry. Also, those games have such meaningless names. They're so bad, nondescript. Yeah, I mean, it's cute games. It's definitely not rare, because like Star Fox has slapped on that game so many ways.
And again, that wasn't their decision. Again, this is Nintendo's direction I'm sure maybe there's things they could. Again, I actually have never played this either, but I would assume there's probably things they could have done better in terms of incorporating Star Fox. But broadly speaking, it's like when you get this directive to just slap it onto a game that you've already been making, it was never likely to turn out that great in that regard, was it?
And there's some places where the Star Fox is integrated in it. We talked about this last week with passive aggressiveness, where it feels like Star Fox was passive aggressively put into the scene. The end, which I don't even, I've talked about it. I don't want to spoil it because it's too stupid. Yeah. It's so stupid.
You have spoiled it for me by talking about it over the years, but that's fine. You don't have to spoil it again. But
it's so blitheringly stupid.
It does sound rather silly.
It feels like this is where the boss was supposed to be, and it being Andross now doesn't make any sense, like in the canon. And they said, okay, we'll make it more clear that it doesn't make sense. Construct this entire scene around the fact this doesn't make sense.
It does make me think of Troy McClure singing, "Oh my God, I was wrong. It was Andross all along." Yes! So, I mean, it does have that going for it.
Yes! It's so stupid. What a dumbass game. Yeah, it's cute.
And Starlink is actually, I have played that. And again, thing is, it is just, it's another game. You know, I mean, it's not a Star Fox game. The way they incorporate the Star Fox characters and stuff is actually, you know, the way they look and everything. I think it's pretty solid. They did a pretty good job. But it's very much, you know, like a lot of things, presumably, having not played that much of their output in recent years, I imagine it's rather consistent with a lot of Ubisoft games. You know what I mean? It doesn't feel like, particularly Star Foxy, you know what I mean? It's just they've done a decent job of incorporating the Star Fox characters and the R-Wing and stuff on an aesthetic level and having some content reserved for that. But, you know, it is its own game. And it's a pretty fun game. It's a pretty well put together game. But
the craft on all the toy thing, the toy to life things are really high quality.
Mm.
So like you have to factor that into how much did they care.
Yeah. So, you know, I think, I wouldn't say, I think they did more than a respectable job, but it's not a Star Fox game. Like, it's far more like a sort of conventional, you know, kind of third person action game of today, you know, than, I would, you know, think of as being something Star Fox. But, you know, even Star Fox Zero just didn't, you know, the control scheme and just the emphasis made all the free roaming, you know, the stuff better, you know, the all range mode, as it was called in Star Fox 64. All that stuff is way better than it was in Star Fox 64. But, you know, it's still, to me, isn't the meat. It isn't the what Star Fox should be about. It's the on-rails linear action stuff that Star Fox should be about. And, there's some good stuff of that in Star Fox Zero, but not that much. That much. I guess because they just got kind of carried away with, the other elements, which were going to be the bits that were more different than in their predecessors. You know, again, they're similar with Star Fox Command, actually. If you watch the video that John Reardon did about the making of Star Fox Command on the NWR YouTube channel, Dylan Cuthbert actually talked about that in terms of basically, you know, they had spent all this time doing, you know, the kind of meat and potatoes of that game, which is a lot of the all range mode type of stuff, with the thought that, you know, they were going to do more linear stuff as well, kind of late in development to kind of intersperse throughout the game. And, you know, Nintendo just kind of drew a line under it and said, nah, you know, this is it. This is the game. There isn't going to be time or, you know, money or whatever to make more kind of traditional Star Fox sequences. So again, I a lot of the time that it's just what Nintendo asks and permits these people to do rather than, you know, what they've done.
All right. Guillaume, would you read our last email?
Sure. Will writes, "Sup, boys. I'm hoping you lot can shed the light of some programming experience on a topic I've been meaning to send you for a while. I was finally driven to action while playing Mario Wonder. While loading, the game depicts the silhouette of Florian in the lower left, standing atop a sawtooth pattern floor. You can press a button to make Florian hop, and the floor appear to slide over. It is possibly the most minimal level of interaction imaginable, but I'm grateful for it. Nintendo knows I'm in a rush to get back in, and they give me a little something to pass the time. The topic is loading screens. My question is, why aren't I playing Pong in basically every loading screen ever? How much faster is the game loading by not letting me play Pong? Do you have any favorite loading screens? Thanks kindly."
Patents are the reason you haven't been doing this.
Yeah, so Namco patented playing a game during a loading screen, right? Like, they patented it for,
yes.
They used it in their Ridge Racer games. They had you play Galaga, basically, during the loading.
Yes.
And then they patented it, and so no one else could do it, basically.
So the funny thing is, they weren't even the first game to do that.
Right. But that didn't stop them.
Somebody probably could have challenged that patent under prior art, but nobody did it. So there was a Commodore 64 plugin that you could buy a license to put other games in your loading screen, because Commodore 64 games loaded off of cassette tapes, like the standard cassette that you would play as an audio device. And so it took for fucking ever for them to load. But also they would fail as they were trying to load. So they'd have to go back and replay over the cassette again to get the data. So it's a super slow mechanism for seeking data out, because they have to spool the data. But also, if they have to go back and do error correction and all that shit, it takes a long time. So you could buy a license to a thing and put a game in your game's loading screens. But... yeah, there was a patent, and it expired in 2015, but essentially that got us through most of the worst of the loading era, because it was the move to disc formats that made it an issue. Because on a cartridge, whatever, it's just there, game go. And then the PlayStation era, the PlayStation 2 era, loading was really bad, really fucking terrible.
Yeah.
It got better as we started having hard drives that you could put elements of the game on, and as drives got faster, and it was just more ability to load stuff. But then you move to Blu-ray, things get slow again. Now games are just installed to these solid state drives that are built into the system, or on the Wii and the Wii U flash memory that's installed on the system. And so things load pretty fast. Now, if you had Xenoblade X on disc, get fucked on the Wii U.
Yeah,
it was,
I mean, in 2015, you know, the Wii U was functionally dead by 2015.
Right.
It had some good games that came out around then, but Xenoblade X was 2015, right? It was right at the end of 2015. But, you know, commercially, it was dead. But, yeah, I mean, Wii U had some really nasty loading times in quite a lot of cases. So, yeah, I mean, it's a shame for the Wii U's sake that the patent still covered that length of time, because they're quite a few games that probably could have used with it.
I mean, Xenoblade X famously had the DLC, which was just packs to store on your hard drive so it loads faster.
Yeah, certainly.
Into your NAND memory, yeah.
But even stuff that you wouldn't necessarily think of, it's been a long time since I played it this way, but I think Tropical Freeze was really quite bad for loading times. Considering it's a side-scrolling platformer with the quite lush polygonal graphics, but still, you know, it's just Wii U, even the system itself at launch and all this kind of stuff with the Miiverse and all that, it's just kind of synonymous to me. If you talk about, long load times that are not like, the 32-bit era or something, that's what I think of is Wii U. And it could have used with having some diversions while all this was going on.
Oh my god. Yeah. I mean, so the thing is, because people didn't do it except Namco, it never sort of hit zeitgeist as a thing you put in your game. And because it's not really a value add, broadly speaking, like nobody's going to buy your game to play the loading screen game. People just didn't put them into the game. And so by the time we got to the space now where we're at, where games load almost instantly, like I could boot up my Xbox from completely off and be in Forza. Well, no, I'd probably get hit by an update that's going to take 75 hours. But assuming I'm fully updated, be in Forza in under a minute and a half and be driving.
Yeah, it's insane.
Because everything is so fast now. The Switch, I can be in a game in seconds. So at this point, no one ever get to play those things. So like, there's no point in putting them in there. So we've probably passed the era of their efficacy and when they would have been useful and could have become something people expect, they couldn't.
But sometimes, you know, you're stuck, watching a screen for a while, and nice to have a little bit, a little something to do. Like, I do enjoy the minimal interaction that Will talks about. I just remember just being able to move the pointer on the Wii, on the screen as the eShop was loading up, you know, that circle that goes around, and I would have the pointer just follow the circle going around because there was nothing else to do.
The Wii U did have one key
little puzzle.
It had the like slots type puzzle, matching thing on the eShop. Because again, the good lord, that eShop could take a while to load.
Oh my god! Well, the current eShop's not much better.
Yeah, the current eShop's terrible too.
The thing with that is because of just the sheer amount of games that are on it, we can't really handle it.
It was fine at one point.
With the Wii U eShop, even just straight away, it was getting into it was problematic, and it almost felt like, am I not playing this matching game right? Is that why it's not loaded? No, of course not. That's madness. So they knew that something had to be there because it was going to be a while.
I remember also watching, this was during the install for Metal Gear Solid 4, just watching Solid Snake smoke a cigarette forever.
Yes.
They were going to install that Blu-ray, and it was going to take, I don't remember, like, I want to say like 30, 40 minutes at least. And it just displayed like various messages about the game or maybe about smoking. I really have no idea anymore. But you just watch a very detailed
where that smoking model is snake. Cool.
Yeah, basically. That was fun. I miss those days. I tried recently-ish. I played the Namco's Ridge Racer 6. So that was a 360 game. I played it on the Xbox Series X, and of course the load times are non-existent, basically. But that game did have basically playable Pac-Man in there, and it doesn't immediately cut off when you. When the loading is over, so you could just keep playing Pac-Man if you wanted to. In fact, there was an achievement about it. You know, if you can get a certain score in Pac-Man, you'd get an achievement.
Is that achievement unachievable now because the game loads too fast?
No, it won't cut you off. It was unachievable because of my lack of Pac-Man skills, apparently. As much as I like Pac-Man Championship Edition and stuff like that, the original Pac-Man, I never bothered to learn the behaviors of the AI and stuff like that. So I'm sure if I did, if I went and got a copy of How to Win at Pac-Man and studied it, I'm sure I could get that achievement. But
we're going back to books now.
Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah, I mean it's sadly is the real basic reality of it is just that it just didn't. People just couldn't do it, so they didn't.
Kind of missed this window, didn't it? Yeah, but I mean, it was like, I guess the other thing I could think of, again, related to the Wii U, is like a Platinum will do sometimes where you kind of get that like simple, like the character is just in a void and you can like practice combos while it's loading. Mm-hmm. So again, like Bayonetta 2 on Wii U or so. But again, like when if you put it on Switch, like I think the load times are quite a lot reduced. So there's less time for you to be, yeah, practicing what, and it like shows like what inputs you're putting in and all that kind of thing. But yeah, and I assume, you know, maybe in the, you know, the 360 PS3 era, like they were still long enough load times on the original Bayonetta for why they came up with that idea in the first place, but it kind of carried over to Wii U. And then, yeah, I assume it's, you know, there's still, you know, you still will get some loaded times in Switch. It tends to be with like games that are ported from other systems as well, doesn't it? A lot of the time that they may suffer the most with load times on Switch, but, yeah, it just doesn't feel as relevant anymore.
Yeah, I think for me, if I was talking about favorite loading screens, it's usually ones that are giving me information that I can actually leverage going out.
Yeah, like those are the ones I like the most.
Like, I don't need dumb trivia or like, hey, here's a tip, but like stuff that gives me information about the mission. So like the Ace Combat games, which ironically could have had them, could have had mini games in them, didn't. They put a lot of effort to give you sit rep info, which is weirdly useful in those games. Beyond just like, here's the plot for what you're at. Like, here's what you're going to need to be aware of when you enter the combat space. Like, here's where the danger is. And if you actually pay attention to those, it can be really useful, especially on like the highest difficulty. Like, it's going to tell you like, shit's really bad in this area. And so mentally, I'm just making notes. Don't go there. Like, come at it from a different angle, because that's bad. That's a bad place. Makes me unhappy. So yeah, that's kind of what I'm looking for in those. But again, they've missed their window now too.
Dragon Quest XI, I think, while loading would basically tell you like, well, the last thing that happened in the story was this, and the place that you want to get to is this. And, that was insanely useful for such a, you know, like with such a long game, with such a big world. And, that should just be a feature of every RPG ever, basically. Because then, like, no matter how long, you know, the last time that you picked up the game was, you get that reminder, like, oh, yeah, that's what happened. Oh, yeah, that's what I should be doing. And then you can just carry on.
Cool. All right. Cool. All right. Well, we're going to wrap the show. We had, like I said, we had a kind of a compressed recording schedule today. Emails, RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com. Please get your feedback for the seventh guest in. Again, this is pretty short game. This is probably one of the shortest retroactive games we've picked in a long time. So please get them in. Discord, forums, email. You can get it to us any way you want. Social media, I guess. Your thoughts on the game, please participate. This is like our interactive segment. I don't know exactly when we're going to release that episode. We're still trying to figure out what our schedule is going to be for end of the year, start of next year. Cause we're going to take a little bit of time off. So we'll figure that out as we go, but get them in for, so we're going to record them in the next week. So get them in as soon as you can. On that, I think we're done. So Greg, what music are we going to wrap this episode with?
Well, so yeah, just I think while we were recording, or maybe shortly before, they had a 3 N64 games going up on the expansion pack at once, which is a little strange. But one of them was sort of tipped by the launch of a separate 18+ NSO app in Japan, which launched with GoldenEye and Jet Force Gemini. This is very strange. Yeah, wow, this game with a robot dog as one of the playable characters is in the 18+ app. I'm not that sure. I guess there's a lot of bugs exploding. But yes, the Jet Force Gemini has come out now, and I'll probably talk about that in a future episode, trying to play it with there's issues with the control scheme, and also, as John Red covered on NWR, the kind of widescreen display of Jet Force Gemini doesn't work like with the properly. It sort of just ends up getting squashed down instead, which is. I'm not exactly sure how that happens with the scaling and stuff and all that, but what's really amusing about it to me is not so much that it was in there, but rather that when there was a trailer that was released on the Japanese Nintendo YouTube channel, it actually had that footage in it with the widescreen just squashed down. you know, I mean, it's one thing to you know, kind of have it be that way, you know, whatever, you know, kind of, I don't know how easy it would be to fix it or whatever. It's another thing to advertise it with this footage that is clearly incorrectly formatted, but it did tickle me. But like, so that'll be for another day. But the music in the game was always something that I rather enjoyed. We have had one song in the past that was a request from MASB from the Riff Essa planet, which I remind you, Rare B, the puerile British people that they are, was an anagram for shit ass. And, you know, there's, there's other planets in the game that are anagrams for wet fart and all this kind of stuff. But this particular bit of music, which suggests a game that is not played, well, was not made by puerile British people just indulging their most sort of base impulses, is very, very nice. It's, you know, more kind of, somber kind of atmospheric stuff rather than a lot of it is, you know, bombastic going for a kind of, you know, John Williams or James Horner kind of feel. Yeah, this is more laid back, kind of stuff, atmospheric. And it's also on a planet that they, as far as I can tell, I mean, there's no dumb joke there. It's just called Water Ruin. So I guess they had some sense of restraint.
I'm bummed out. I think they should have made sure that everything was a poop reference. It would have been much, much more. Well, I mean, there is a lot of poopy sounds in that game. So
oh, certainly. There's no end of them indulging themselves in it. But like, we'll talk
every
about
step,
that.
Every step of fart. All right. Well, on that, it is time for us to go. Bye, everybody.
Later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.